Governor Holcomb's State of the State. Protests don't materialize at the State House, plus Mike Pence back home and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 22nd, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Governor Eric Holcomb announced in his State of the State address he wants to create a new regional development initiative that he says will help the state's economy recover from the COVID-19 pandemic. The address, due to security concerns across the country tied to the presidential inauguration, was pre-taped away from the State House. Holcomb began with a somber reflection on the toll COVID-19 has had on Indiana.
It's impossible to calculate the far-reaching ripple effect of the personal and community loss of lives and livelihoods.
After that, the usual talking points. His recently announced budget proposal, improvements in job creation and training, infrastructure investments, and more. Then the new announcement, a regional development program through the Indiana Economic Development Corporation.
The IEDC will work with regions that collaborate to develop strategies designed to improve quality of place, advance industry sector development, and grow workforce development initiatives among regions and educators and employers and our state's workforce.
The program's details, including funding, haven't been decided. Is Governor Holcomb's regional development proposal a good one? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanes, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, a good idea?
Well, A, it's an idea that was tried before and scrapped under the Pence administration after 1 year. But what I love about this is Republicans always want smaller government. So we have 92 counties, and we have, something like 1,000 trusteeships, and we have 270 school districts. And now we're going to put another layer over that of appointed people, not elected people, but appointed people. I mean, you know, the problem with this whole idea, and I think they found that out after they tried it under Mike Pence, is when you have appointed officials there, you can have the possibility that somebody's favorite, program is the one that gets funded, whether it's what the region needs or not. I think it's his attempt to try to say that he's doing something bold, because frankly, everything he's doing is small bore. And I think this one will be doomed to failure the same way.
Jennifer Hollowell, a lot of people noticed or seemed to note similarities between this proposal and the Regional Cities Initiative that Mike Pence created when he was governor, that did one round of projects, well-received, and then it just sort of disappeared. Is this the same thing over again, and should we be trying it over again?
Well, there were a lot of success stories that came out of the Regional Cities program, without a doubt, in all corners of the state, a lot of projects that happened that otherwise would not have. But I want to kind of take a step back, really, and just say how remarkable it is that we are in a position where the governor is even proposing the potential of funding something new, a regional recovery initiative, when you consider the fact that we're still in a global pandemic. States all around us are having to make drastic cuts to their budget, and we're now in a position where we're restoring what would have been potential cuts and talking about the fact that we might be able to invest more money. And I don't look at this as a new layer. What we're talking about is getting regions, cities, counties, towns, to collaborate and work together. And too often in the past, because of political boundaries or geographic boundaries or whatever, we haven't had the kind of coordination that should have been happening. What we've seen in a few different places across the state is that when folks are working together and not just competing town to town, you can get a lot more done. And there's certainly different strengths that different communities can bring. And so I think it's fantastic that we'd be considering something like this in the future.
Nikki Kelly.
So we didn't use the money the federal government gave us to help people. I suppose that's something you could do.
Nikki Kelly, when we talked to, when we got the briefing about the State of the State address from Holcomb administration officials, we asked them about how similar this seemed to regional cities. Did they give any sort of indication of what it will look like in terms of, yes, it will be the same, no, it won't?
Yeah, I think they admitted it's similar. They also said that maybe projects that have maybe a healthcare focus or a more, you know, social health focus might get a little more look. The interesting part I found about it is it sort of seemed tacked on. Like, it wasn't part of his agenda. It wasn't part of his budget proposal. It doesn't have any estimates on dollars. It's an if we can get to it, maybe this would be kind of cool proposal. So, I mean, I guess we'll see if we get there, but there needs to be a lot more details than what we were given this week.
Yeah, and those obviously still to come. John Schwanes, I want to step back and ask you sort of a bigger picture question, which I know is dangerous asking you that kind of question, but this was obviously a speech that was very different in location, in the way it was delivered for obvious reasons, but overall, did it feel like, other than the sort of technical aspects of it, did it feel like a different sort of state of the state?
I think it did feel different, and maybe that's because it's hard to get past the lack of an audience, the absence of the applause lines, the obligatory introductions of, it seems obligatory, at least in recent years, of guests in the balcony, the visual aids that have become into favor with these speeches. So it, you know, did, was the substance the same in that he talked about overall the state is in good shape because of X, Y, and Z that my administration did? Yeah, that was there. Did he outline the biggest challenges, which we already knew going into this, certainly because of COVID-19? Yes, he did. But it's hard to get past the fact that after looking at, you know, a lot of these speeches, as we all have, and listening to a lot of them, it had a different rhythm to it, certainly. So yeah, substance the same, but style really did strike me as dramatically different.
All right. Well, I want to stay on topic a little bit because Governor Holcomb took time in his State of the State address to address school vouchers with a caveat that was a surprise to some. Holcomb's address touted his administration's guarantee of K-12 funding during the pandemic, regardless of whether students learned virtually or in person, and he pushed for help to address learning loss, something House Republicans are proposing. He also emphasized that parents, in his words, deserve to have options about where they send their child to be educated.
But at the same time, those options shouldn't come at the expense of the public school system, which educates 90% of Hoosier children.
That's the sort of line traditional public school advocates have been preaching for years. House Republicans will push to expand Indiana's school voucher program this session, and Senate Democratic leader Greg Taylor senses a fight could be coming.
That was a tough statement for him to make, but the right statement. Do I think he's going to be successful? Yeah, if he puts down the gauntlet and says, this is what we're going to do, that is what's going to happen.
Jennifer Hollowell, is there a fight looming over school voucher expansion?
I don't think there should be a fight. I mean, I think what the last year has shown us is that what schools and teachers and various educational programs have done, taken different choices, has really highlighted the fact that parents and students need to be empowered to choose the school and the program that is best for them. The governor's proposing adding another $377 million in new money for education. And a big priority for House Republicans is House Bill 1005, which would expand voucher eligibility for middle-class families and also create education savings accounts for children with special needs, which is particularly critical as we saw many students with special needs having a difficult time making the transition to virtual learning and need additional things like tutoring and other things. So I think that now is the time to expand on this and give Hoosiers the option to go to the school that is best suited for them.
Ann Delaney, what Governor Holcomb said in his speech sounded an awful lot like, well, what you say on this show an awful lot. Were you surprised?
I think that's right. And I was very pleased to hear it because this isn't about choice. What they're talking about doing is doubling people with incomes, families with incomes of $144,000 would have these vouchers. If they're going to private schools now or religious schools now, they're paying for it, and they can pay for it. And this is going to take money from public education, which I think the governor actually understated it. It's 93% of the students in this state go to public education. We're not paying teachers what he wants to pay them, what they need to be paid. And instead, we want to give people making close to $150,000 a year a windfall. If they're sending their children to school now in private education, they can afford it. And we don't have to take more money from the students whose parents can't afford it in order to enable that. So I think I was very happy to hear him say that, because I think the bill is ridiculous. I think it's interesting that we can have health savings accounts for children with special needs to go. I think that's a nice proposal. The problem is that those charter schools that vouchers get, you know, that exist, and these other private institutions are not obligated to take children with special needs. In fact, many of them will not take special needs children. So I think it's ironic that we're coming up with that idea. At the same time, we're not forcing those institutions to admit children with special needs. If one went with the other, it would make a little bit more sense. Instead, it's a blatant appeal to a more sympathetic kind of student without really providing them with what they need.
John Schwanes, were you surprised to hear this from the governor?
I was, because he wasn't any need for him to raise these questions or to raise the hopes of people who are concerned about the growth in Indiana, the aggressive growth in recent years of school choice programs in Indiana. You know, yes, you can. It's a little confusing what he said, because there's just a little bit of hope for both sides and a little bit of fear for both sides. But by saying this, which I'm not sure how else you can interpret the notion, that just one statement that he said about protecting public schools, that he didn't need to do it. It may signal that he recognizes that if you look back at the funding trends in the past few budgets, the yes, schools as a whole, K through 12, have, well, it was often labeled historic increases, and I guess technically speaking, they were historic. But who fared best in those? Which schools fared best? They tended to be parochial, the private schools who were getting vouchers on a percentage basis. And I think he sees perhaps that is unsustainable for the overall health of public education in Indiana.
Nikki Kelly, because of the change of circumstances at the State House, which we're going to talk a little bit more about later in this show, we didn't get the normal post-State of the State press conferences with the Republican legislative leaders. Was that a little more disappointing because of what Governor Holcomb said?
Yeah, man, did I want to hear Speaker Houston, you know, have a response to that. You know, 1005, the bill that we're talking about, I looked at the fiscal note this week. It is $100 million in each year of new expense. And, you know, to do that at a time when we're saying we don't have any money, ongoing money, this is an ongoing program, not one time. When we don't have any money to improve teacher salaries, that is a big, big sell.
All right. Well, it's not often that a lack of anything happening is newsworthy, but this week, protests failed to materialize at the Indiana State House, despite FBI warnings of armed gatherings at all 50 state capitals around President Joe Biden's inauguration. Governor Eric Holcomb announced last Friday the state government complex in downtown Indianapolis would be closed to the public through Wednesday, the day of Biden's inauguration, and the General Assembly canceled all legislative activity for the week. But neither Sunday, when a protest was advertised, nor Wednesday, the day of the presidential inauguration, saw a single Trump supporter rallying outside the State House. Holcomb stood by his decision.
And I will always err on the side of caution and always be safe, not sorry.
State Police Superintendent Doug Carter said he wishes he could predict human behavior.
That would give us a really clear picture of what the future might look like, but I don't think anybody expects us to be able to do that.
Carter says his advice to the governor and legislative leaders was influenced by the bombing in Nashville, Tennessee on Christmas, the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol earlier this month, and, quote, one of the most likely divisive transfers of power in the nation's history. Nikki Kelly, should Holcomb's decision really be second-guessed?
don't think it's as much second guessing, because I was the one asking these questions too. It's just a fair question, because I think the concern is that we're setting some sort of precedent. You know, for decades I've been covering this building. We've had thousands and thousands of people, and sometimes they weren't all friendly. And we've never shut it down. And they said repeatedly there was no credible threat. So there is sort of a disconnect between, if there's no credible threat, you know, why did we give up 4 days of work for the legislature?
John Schwanes, I saw reactions on both sides of this, which was people thought, well, boy, wasn't this an overreaction? You know, that's a whole week of legislative activity gone. And yet at the same time, other people who said, well, what, did you want him to not do anything and be wrong? So was this the right amount of reaction, if you will, from the governor and legislative leaders?
I think it probably was. And in fact, I'm not sure this is even a close call. Have we forgotten already what we saw when we watched with horror what happened at the U.S. Capitol just a few weeks back? You know, there was certainly no precedent for that, unless you go back to the War of 1812. With that kind of insurrection and that kind of direct assault on our nation's capital. So it's easy to say we've had angry crowds at the State House. We have, but we are in uncertain times. We're in unprecedented times. So it seems to me that this had to be the call that was made, because think about the flip side. If the decision had been made to proceed with normal meetings and proceedings of the General Assembly, and then something had happened and there had been a loss of life or some other sort of tragedy, then, I'd hate to think about the repercussions and the second guessing then. So it seems like this really did have to happen. And I'd say a week without General Assembly proceedings at this point in the process, no one will even notice it at the end. I mean, it's inconsequential in terms of the whole rhythm of the session, it seems to me.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question: did Governor Holcomb make the right call to shut down state government buildings out of concern for protests, even though they never materialized? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, we asked you if the second impeachment of Donald Trump would have any impact on his political future. Most of you said yes. Very few said yes positive. 48% said it will have a negative impact, but 46% say no, it won't really affect his political future. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, now former Vice President Mike Pence returned home to Indiana this week after attending President Joe Biden's inauguration. Supporters greeted the former Indiana governor and his family when they landed at the Columbus Municipal Airport Wednesday afternoon. Pence spoke to the crowd, thanking God, his family, the Indiana Republican Party, and former President Trump for the opportunity to serve as vice president.
Having spent time with Americans in virtually every state in the Union, I leave this position more impressed with the American people than when I started.
Pence also congratulated Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris on taking their offices. The Hoosier Republican added he's promised his wife Karen they would move back to Indiana this summer. John Schwanes, what do you think is next for Mike Pence?
Well, he's indicated certainly that he wants to stay in Indiana, that he has promised his wife that they are going to move back this summer. I'll take him at his word. I asked the governor, I should point out this week, we've been talking a lot about the governor. He was the guest I welcomed to Indiana lawmakers.
First
on many
of the year, John,
television.
First of the year.
Hey, I had to have it, you know, it was the governor. But he addressed this, and I said, hey, you governor, you pointed out that during the State of the State that there are 110,000 unfilled Hoosier jobs out there. Perhaps you could talk to the former vice president and maybe, you know, throw him a bone. Obviously, that's probably not the kind of job that the former vice president is looking for. But in this kind of virtual world, he, I'm sure, can live in Indiana and be a guest or have a program on any number of networks or any something that would be to his liking in terms of maintaining his visibility, which I think is probably a priority for him.
Yeah, Nikki Kelly, a lot of us assume that Mike Pence has presidential ambitions in the 2024 race. He's certainly considered one of the favorites to get the nomination for the Republicans at this point, though there's a lot of time left. Are you a little surprised that he'll end up back in Indiana, at least for now?
No, I mean, 4 years is a long time. He can spend some time here and try to keep his profile up. I imagine maybe a book deal might be coming. You know, he did once, you know, have a radio show. So maybe some sort of foray into that
and
to try to keep his, to try to keep his profile up. But I think he can absolutely do that from Indiana.
Jennifer Hollowell, if you're advising Mike Pence on what to do next, assuming that presidential ambitions are still in his sight, what would you suggest he do?
Well, I don't think he needs my advice, but I expect that he will probably be, you know, settling into private life and mapping out the plan for their future. I assume that part of that is going to be spending some time talking about some of the key policy accomplishments of the last 4 years and defending against what I assume will be Biden administration and Democrat congressional leaders' attempts to roll back tax reform and some of the other things that that he championed over the last few years. And then, you know, I think the most obvious thing is he's going to play a major role in the 2022 midterm elections. You know, there are like 38, I think, governor's races across the country. And I expect that he will crisscross the country helping stump for House and Senate Republican candidates in an effort to regain majorities. And he'll be a star, I'm sure, requested all across the country and will play a big role there.
Yeah, and Delaney, what do you think, what are you looking for out of Mike Pence over the next few years?
Well, I think he'll want to keep his visibility up. I'm not sure how much of a draw he'll be for Republican primary voters in the next go-round, since he's obviously broken with their leader, Donald Trump, who, and they still believe the election was stolen from them. I mean, I think he did a lot for his public profile nationally by acknowledging the fact that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were elected and attending the inauguration. I think he deserves some credit for that. It would have been nice if he wasn't repeating the lies from Election Day through the storming of the Capitol, but he did, like a lot of other Republican leaders. So I don't know how that cuts. His biggest problem is there is no charisma there. You know, I mean, he's a good enough speaker, and he oozes sincerity, but he doesn't draw the same kind of avid support that a Donald Trump does on the Republican side. And we don't know whether Donald Trump's going to try to run again or not. I mean, if he's impeached and they vote to prevent him from seeking office, he'll still take that to the Supreme Court. It'll be constant turmoil from Donald Trump between now and 2024. And I don't know how Mike Pence rises above that or stands out in that environment, frankly.
I want to actually.
He's a great speaker. He also has the depth of relationships. I mean, he has an incredible network with donors that he's built for years and years and years, right? And elected officials. So, yes, he has star power.
I want to say.
How many of those big donors give to him any more than they do to the congressional people who kept denying the election of Joe Biden?
I want to stay on this topic for a second because something that Ann said struck me. Mike Pence was a big draw before the world of Donald Trump. But I think Donald Trump has shifted what we think of as a big draw in politics. I mean, nobody was drawing those kind of crowds that we regularly saw from his presidential run before 2016 through really, you know, the last few weeks. So assuming that, and I know this is perhaps a big assumption, and I'll go to Nikki Kelly on this, assuming that Donald Trump is not the candidate, is not a candidate in 2024, are the goalposts moved, or do they settle back to where they were in terms of what we consider a big draw on the political scene?
I think they'll probably settle back. I mean, I think Donald Trump was clearly a different candidate and a different president than we've ever seen. And I think we'll probably, you know, go back to more sort of status quo when it comes to these kinds of things.
And then, John Schwanes, I want to finish with you on this, which is, if Donald Trump does try to run again in 2024, assuming impeachment, conviction for impeachment doesn't happen, and so he is able to run again, what does that do to Mike Pence's political future?
I think Mike Pence has a future. Let's say that, because he, let's not forget, before Donald Trump was even on the scene, when people saw him as kind of a, you know, real estate mogul and a network TV guy. We had Mike Pence, who year after year was winning straw poll votes at NCPAC and other conservative groups. He was the darling of the evangelical wing of the party. He was the favorite of the most conservative factions within the party. So I presume that I don't think he's done anything necessarily. You know, yes, he did break with the president in the end, but those are alliances that preceded this fascination with the 45th president. And I presume that those ties would still be strong.
Yeah, I think maybe that's the biggest, you know, we talked about what will Mike Pence do next. I think the question, what will Donald Trump do next, maybe hangs over all of that, but we'll see. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.